Hello and welcome to Being Well. I'm Forrest Hanson. If you're new to the show, thanks for joining us today. And if you've listened before, welcome back. I'm really looking forward to today's conversation, where we're going to be exploring more body-based or somatic approaches to working with trauma with a truly world-class expert. I'm joined by two people. First, he's a clinical psychologist, best-selling author, and he's my dad, Dr. Rick Hanson. Dad, how are you doing today?
I'm doing great, Forrest. I'm happy to be with you, of course, and I'm tickled pink to be with my friend and someone I've learned immensely from, Dr. Peter Levine. Peter, through and through, from the start, has been just the super real deal. And when I was a young pup and got to meet him for the first time, Peter, you were genuinely kind to me and benevolent and took time, and a lot of people wouldn't have done that. So I just want to express my gratitude for you and say, absolutely, you're the real deal. And I'm also tickled pink that we're going to have a chance to explore your new book, Autobiography of Trauma, A Healing Journey, in which you get very intimate, very, very intimate. So I'm glad to be here.
Yeah, equal mente. Good to see you.
So if you are new to Peter's work, he's the founder and president of the Irgos Institute for Somatic Education. He's taught at a number of universities, including UC Berkeley, Go Bears, and has received a Lifetime Achievement Award from Psychotherapy Networker, in addition to a bunch of similar awards from a number of other organizations. And he spent probably about the past 50 years or so working on somatic experiencing, which is an approach to therapy that has been taught to over 30,000 therapists.
I think it's 60,000. 60,000.
60,000. Well, you got to update your website,
oh,
Peter.
Okay, I'll mention
that. Oh, man,
that.
That's twice as many. 60,000. Oh, man. I'm like, I'm way lowballing you here.
Yeah, no, it's caught in 44 countries now.
That's
and at
awesome.
One time, everything was on my shoulders. You know, that was a burden, really. I realized there was something important, but the system wasn't open to that. You know, and I was considered to be a fringe or even doing something that was dangerous to actually have people feel their bodies. Things have changed dramatically.
So Peter, just to start, your recent book, Autobiography of Trauma, is of course very personal.
Yeah.
And it's interesting that the through line in the book is trauma itself. Your personal history of trauma, your reflections about it, your working of that material, and the ways in which your personal experiences have helped to give rise, have been the birthplace, really, the midwife and crucible of your work, somatic experiencing. And when you look back on your history, and you're, like me, old enough now to have some history, if you were to pick the really short list, I mean, it's hard to pick two or three major themes in the braided weave of that history that are relevant to people listening. What are the two or three themes that really stand out for you, especially when you integrate the personal and the professional?
Yeah. Talking about our age, because I'm now at the age where I clearly have less time ahead, even if it's still vital and involved and passionate. So I decided it was a good idea. It was time for me to really look at the arc of my story of how I became shaped, how I was shaped, how I developed, where I am in my world right now. And that was the beginning, but I had no interest. I never thought of it as something that would actually be published as a book. And a really good friend of mine, Laura, she really encouraged me to write it as a book. And I remember saying, there's no way. It's too personal. It's too raw. It's too vulnerable. And she said, but I think that's exactly what could help other people. But, you know, a lot of times when I don't know what steps are going or I don't know what needs to come next, I'll have a dream. And I had this following dream. I'm standing in front of a field, and I have in my hands two reams of paper. And there's obviously a manuscript because there's something written, typewritten on it. And I look to the left and I look to the right. And again, I just feel I'm stuck. I don't know what to do. I don't know where to go. And in that stuckness, from behind came a strong breeze. And it took all of these pages and blew them out into the meadow to land where they might land. So that's how I started. And that's just kind of take this one step further. when I was asked to present, you know, the evolution of psychotherapy, and that's what the Ericksonian Institute, and they have sometimes like between 5 and 8,000 people attending. So this was the first time I was going to talk publicly, and that was in December, about the book. And when I stood up and I looked out, you know, at these thousands, the words wouldn't come. They got stuck in my throat. But then I remembered the endorsements that a number of people had made, including you, and that how supportive they were. And I could feel that support. Literally, I could feel the support by my side. I could feel my support from my back, like people had my back.
Yeah.
And then I could speak. And that kind of turned the corner. So that's really how the book began.
So if I could say it back to you, to me, that's one of the through lines in your work, the connection of the depth of injury and wounding that people can experience, which then calls for an equal depth, even a greater depth in tenderness and caring.
Yes.
Which you yourself really deliver and which you are speaking here has carried you in some ways along. The breeze in the dream, the support of the people in the audience, the endorsements and all the rest of that. So that's such a crucial through line, speaking to my question here about through lines for you, the importance of support. Is there another major through line when you look back on your work connecting personal and professional?
My family, my father, parents in particular, were threatened by the mob. It's a long story, but they wanted to get my father to testify against Johnny DiGuardi, Johnny Dio. And he was one of the most ruthless killers in the entire mob. He basically told my father that if my father testified, he'd find his family, us, laying face down in the East River. But every other Friday, a lawyer would come. I later found out it was from the mafia, to kind of coach my father in what to say and what not to say. So me and my brothers, we knew something was wrong, but it never got talked about. We never got this message that we're going to take care of you. You know, we'll keep you safe. So we didn't know that. And so we lived with that uncertainty. And in many cases, it's the milieu in which trauma occurs that's the most troubling.
That's a real headline here. Thank you. The context, the setting, the milieu, including what's missing.
That's right. You got it. So anyhow, I started, this was about 30 years ago. I was teaching my work to a number of people, and it was starting to become into the world and be accepted. And around that time, I started having some disturbing sensations, feelings, little flashes of images. And I realized it was time for me to take a dose of my own medicine. So I asked one of my students, former students, to guide me. And one of the things in somatic experiencing, a couple of things, we never go right into the trauma. We don't have people reliving the trauma over and over again. I think that's a faulty approach to trauma, this kind of prolonged exposure therapy. And
that's extremely important what you're saying there, and it opposes much
conventional
received wisdom in the field, and it's an extremely important point.
And so maybe I can use my story to kind of illustrate that. So when I was with my guide, she delicately kind of worked with some very positive sensations that were just starting to emerge in my body. And I went to the following memory. When I was 4 or 5 years old, my birthday, my parents, it must have been in the night or early in the morning, came into the room and laid the tracks for a model train or underneath my bed, out into the room, and then back again, and then in an oval back underneath my bed again. So when I awoke to the train going around. And to say I was excited would be an understatement. I was beside myself, and I literally jumped out of bed and went to the transformer so I could control the speed and also make the horn go toot toot. And although I didn't have the words for it, in that moment, I felt cared for. I felt safe. I felt that I was loved. And that was the feeling that I didn't get in the milieu with the mafia.
Even though your parents did love you, which makes another really crucial point, that what counts is what we experience.
That's right.
And sometimes there's a disconnect between, quote unquote, objective reality, your parents' love for you and their willingness, in your father's case, to make a lot of sacrifices to protect his family. But yet that isn't how it landed for you when you were young.
And there were times when there was a lot of trauma that occurred from the family, in the family. But, you know, I mean, that's not so uncommon. I think when you said it, I think it actually moved me when you said they really loved you. I mean, I was just saying essentially that. But with your words, your reflecting, it really touched me. I felt an opening here in my chest. Mm. Yeah, which is nice. And from this memory, my guide noticed a slight shuffling movements with my feet. And it was more like rapid. And so she did again a very thing that we often do in somatic experience, having me slow that down and feel it as I slowed it down. And during this time, you know, when our family was in danger, and it was like my legs got pulled out from under me. And there was a park at the other side of the road in front of the house where, or the apartment where we lived. Because trauma does that, it knocks us off our feet.
Yeah.
But then one day, and this was the park I loved. It was my refuge in a way. But something horrible happened. One day, I climbed the fence, and off to my left, I saw a group of, I'm sure they were from the mob. They were gangsters.
By the way, before you go further, Peter, I just want to alert people that this is a really horrific thing that happened to you and very traumatizing. So, you know, people listening should just be aware of that. Okay, so with a lot of respect to the enormity of what occurred.
Yeah, I'm not going to go into details. But anyhow, I realized if I went back to the to climb back on the fence, I would be an easy target. So I ran back into the bushes, as I had done many times before. But sadly, they followed me and pulled me to the ground and violently raped me. And there was a reason I realized this much later, that what they wanted to do, again, was to scare my father off so I would tell my parents about what happened. But I didn't. I didn't tell them because of the shame. And I didn't tell myself. And in a way, I put that in the corner, like I walled it off from any memory. Until that day with my student who guided me deftly there so I wasn't overwhelmed at any time and could go back and forth between these exciting sensations I felt at my birthday and the horror of what happened. And so I was able to, with her guidance, to put it back in the past where it belonged. And again, that's an important thing in somatic experiencing approach. Is we try to come into the periphery. We touch into these difficult sensations. We don't go to memories, but memories may come up. But we, again, work to see where the body has become stuck and how we can help move it through in time.
May I just sort of say back to you some headlines that I'm hearing here?
Yeah.
One is, so true to your work, is picking up the physicalization of trauma. I think people talk about the body speaking in its way, like your feet moving. Another key element is what you call, I believe, pendulation, where you swing like a pendulum into the material, you touch it, and then you swing back to resource yourself so you can go into it again, maybe moving back and forth, including the resourcing of that beautiful birthday memory with the trains and all of that, right? And then very interestingly, in part, as you well know, in terms of how the brain works, oftentimes trauma gets frozen and it's decontextualized.
That's right.
particularly really early trauma before the hippocampus has become anatomically mature around the
pre-verbal, non-verbal,
The third or fourth birthday, because there's no locating in time, and you're helping it be located in time, as in that was horrible and it was then, and this is now. The light is coming through the window. You're safe. You're okay. I'm with you. This is now. Really, really crucial thing. So I just wanted to say back to you, you know, some of the huge headlines, you know, that I'm getting from what you're saying here.
I really appreciate that. And, you know, when I finally decided to write the book as a book, I really still had to test myself that this could help people, the readers, make some more compassion for what happened to them. And also encouraging people to write their own stories, because I believe, truly believe, that we all, whatever our history, whatever our background, we all have important stories to tell. It can be just to us, or it can be more public. But I really encourage people to start thinking about their life and the arc of their life and where they came from and where they ended up.
Peter, I have a question for you, but it's quite a personal question. And if you want to, you know, skirt around it in any ways, you're more than welcome to. For many people, traumatic experiences happen to their body or are associated with their body. You just shared an example of this. Like, that's a very intimate example. Something bad happened to you physically. And then you went on to create this whole methodology of therapy that's tied to the body. There's something in that that really, I don't know, there's really something there, for starters.
Yeah.
And for many people, when they go through these kinds of experiences, they understandably have an enormous amount of pain, shame, judgment, discomfort associated with their physical form.
Right, right.
And so you're using all of these somatic, body-driven tools to help people access feeling better, but the body's a painful place to be.
That's right.
And that seems like this really core tension inside a lot of the work that you do. And I'm just wondering how you help people work through that, how maybe you worked through that in some ways in your own life, wherever you want to take that.
Let me just start with the archetype of Chiron from the Greek mythology, the wounded healer, that we all have to heal our own wounds, at least adequately, before we can be present with others. And being present with others is essential. You know, in one of my books, In an Unspoken Voice, I write that trauma is not so much or not just what happened to us, but it's rather what we hold inside in the absence of that empathetic, that present empathetic other. And I think that's really critical, to have that witness there who's basically by their presence is saying that I'm here for you, and I'll stay here. So that's essential. And working with pain and shame, you know, very often trauma comes not in the form of, you know, a flashbacks, the traditional models of trauma, but as physical symptoms, as pain, and as corrosive emotions such as shame. And shame really strangulates the self, strangulates the spirit, and holds it hostage. And so working with shame is an important component in working with trauma. When we are feeling shame, our bodies do a very specific posture. So we look away and down, because we want to avert anybody's eye contact. So we look away and down, and then our body collapses. That just robs the vital energy, and we collapse like this. And so we stay in this embodied state, this physiological shame state, and it seems like it's going to be impossible to do anything to get out of it. But one of the things I discovered, and my guide worked with this with me, is that when we move into that shame just the smallest amount and then come back out, and then just sense what's going on in our body. A lot of times there could be tingling, vibration, inner movements, things like that. And then just letting that settle, letting that go to equilibrium, to balance. And then again, going into that movement just a little bit more this time, just touching into it, often images come up from where the shame came from, and then slowly coming back up. And what I've noticed when you come back up from that, the chest, I'm doing this as an exercise, my chest is expanding. I feel something that's akin to pride and even dignity. So again, as we find somatic ways to, because it's the imprint that this has on the body. As I think about it, most of the people that, when I don't see people privately anymore, but when I did for years, many of them, not, I would say most of them, presented with pain and shame, and the way that both of that just robbed our vitality. So again, how to work with that in a safe, in a relatively safe way, and just to be supported in doing that.
What basically blew my mind when I first learned about your approach was its fundamental view that we are innately healthy. Mm. And what trauma does is it blocks innately healthy expressions, such as fleeing or fighting back or using your feet, let's say, in your own personal memory to get away. So one of the really very powerful things you do when you work with people is to enact in various ways, creatively and safely, yeah, a kind of a completion of the arc of coping to challenge that was thwarted as people were defeated, entrapped, and then locked, yes, in as a result.
Yes.
And I think that's really quite fascinating, how you help people complete that arc, like the release of shame and the physical arc that's involved in that, with the idea that simply unlocking, unleashing, you know, the tiger within that can really complete that arc, that itself is profoundly healing.
Yeah.
And I find that both brilliant and really, really helpful.
In a way, we go back to where the person got thwarted in their basic survival,
yep,
instincts or survival motor patterns, where it got stuck, and then help the person lead it towards completion. Because when we complete an act, then that becomes beautiful. I know it might seem a little bit strange, but that's been my experience. In the completion itself, we find the roots of freedom. As far as I know, the only way to do that is with the body, because again, that's where it got stuck. And that's where those movements, like you alluded, when I was working with my guide, seeing my feet moving as though I were fleeing. And yeah, I couldn't flee then because I was overwhelmed. I was tackled. I was injured. So again, being able to complete that and to defang it is a critical element of good, sound trauma therapy.
I have an oddball question for us. Forrest and I prepped quite a lot for this, Peter, because we, you know, we wanted to rise to your level.
Sure, it shows.
And so, but this is an oddball question. Forrest just doesn't know that this is going to come. So,
oh, I'm excited.
Yeah. So lately, in a way that's really good, I've had several people write me related to some talks I've given and so forth, who basically are challenging the common mindfulness-centered instruction and the classic therapeutic instruction, like feel that in your body, you know, locate the sense of that emotion in your body. Where do you feel that in your body? What is your body telling you? Blah, blah, blah. These are very well-intended and very standard kinds of, sure, instructions. These are people who are writing me and saying, well, and this languaging is somewhat fraught and controversial at this point, but people so-called in the kind of more autistic spectrum, neurodivergent, I think atypicality is much more typical than we've, you know, previously, you know,
I agree,
credited.
It's a big spectrum.
Yeah.
Big spectrum.
For me, it's a kind of respect for diversity. How do you include people who experience things? There's a wide range of the ways of what we experience, and an even wide range in how we experience, and a really wide range in access to our experiences or the connection between language and our experiences, especially experiences that are not languaged well.
Yes.
And so what do you do with people who are, you know, in probably a third of the population for whom kind of the well-intended previous suggestions, oh, where do you get in touch with that in your body? It's like, And then they start to feel there's something wrong with themselves or failing the therapy.
Yep. You have to meet people where they are. If they're intellectual, you meet or at an intellectual or academic or scientific point of view. And then if you see something spark, then you say, it's just looked like you just all of a sudden felt some warmth coming into your face. I wonder if you noticed that. One of the last clients that I saw was, I saw him especially because, in a way, because of that. He was a kid who was clearly on the spectrum. And he heard me give a lecture and he asked to see me. And he came in with his computer. He wouldn't look at me. He would look only at the computer and he would write me an email. And then I would read the email and then I would write back to him. So he would come down, you know, every year for about 3 or 4 sessions. So after the first year, the second year, he did kind of the same thing, but he looked at me for a momentarily. The next year he came, he didn't come with his computer. And we just sat together and just spent some time together. I asked him some things about what he was interested in, why he wanted to meet with me and so forth. And the next year he came back and he had met a woman, a girlfriend, and they got married. And every year they sent me this beautiful, beautiful postcard around Christmas. What that story tells me is, again, you have to meet people where they are. And when you do that and they know you're doing that, then they're willing to take the risk of taking a next step. And again, getting those postcards every year, I put them on my refrigerator. You know, I'm just deeply touched. And again, reminded that if we ask the person, well, what are you feeling in your body? You're likely to put them in a defensive position. So So I think basically, I think you said it and I said it. Slightly different words, but I think it's the same thing. How to meet people, how to feel that you're being met, that they're being met.
As somebody who has a long history of painful acne and related skin issues, I know how great it is to not stress about what's going on with your skin. That's where our sponsor, OneSkin, comes in. Most skincare available on the market is designed to provide a temporary reduction in symptoms without addressing many of the underlying causes. OneSkin's OS01 line of products targets cellular senescence. This is a key hallmark of aging, directly with their proprietary OS01 peptide. The OS01 peptide can reduce the number of senescent cells by up to 50%, strengthening the skin barrier, improving skin health markers, and reducing visible signs of aging. I've been using their OS01 face topical supplement, and I love how simple it is. You just cleanse, you pat your skin dry, and apply twice daily. OneSkin is the world's first skin longevity company. By focusing on the cellular aspects of aging, OneSkin keeps your skin looking and acting younger for longer. Get started today with 15% off using code BEINGWELL at oneskin.co. That's 15% off oneskin.co with code BEINGWELL. After you purchase, they'll ask where you heard about them, and please support the show and tell them that we sent you. We all know that the food we eat today affects how we feel tomorrow. But what if I told you that it could affect how you felt in 20 years? We're learning so much these days about our bodies, and one of the challenges for people right now is that there's an enormous amount of information out there, but it can be difficult to separate fact from fiction. We had Dr. Tim Spector on the podcast a few years ago. He's a professor of genetic epidemiology and the scientific co-founder at Zoe. And the Zoe Science and Nutrition podcast is truly one of the best resources out there when it comes to this stuff. With the help of world-leading scientists, they help you make smarter health choices every week. And you don't have to just take my word for it. Avid podcast fan Naomi's Apple review says Zoe Science and Nutrition is super easy to consume, even if you don't understand the science, with loads of actionable tips, a great mix of guests, and interesting, cutting-edge science. With the Zoe Science and Nutrition podcast, you can join Naomi and millions of others transforming their health. Find it wherever you listen to podcasts. For many of the people who are listening, that sounds like a really wonderful thing to be met by somebody else in that way, I would imagine. It's also quite an unusual experience for people outside of the therapeutic space. I think that's probably fair to say, unfortunately, in life. And most of the people who are listening to the podcast, or certainly most of the people broadly in the country, will never go to therapy. Mm-hmm. I think that we probably have a disproportionately high number of therapy-going persons listening to the show, but you know, even so, many people listening will never have the access to work with a therapist or a somatic experiencing person. For people who are in that position, but they like your work and they would love to be able to get more in touch with themselves in a variety of different ways, maybe develop interoception, but they've always struggled with that. Maybe using my dad as an example, he's referred to himself when he was a kid as being kind of numb from the neck down. What would you start to do, or what would you recommend to somebody for being able to develop that kind of facility that might give them access to some of the other tools that you teach?
Yeah. Well, as you say, it is. It's interesting. It's a little bit unusual, you know, and if we can get into a judgment about a person and say something like, well, what's wrong with you? I mean, don't say it exactly like that. But if you're doing it like a clinical assessment rather than what happened to you, and can I reach out my hand to you? Now, one of the key things is about evoking curiosity. If you're able to help a person become curious about their felt experience, then you've gotten 51% there. And again, that's not a given. To actually, when we meet a person, to get to know them, to talk about what's important to them, to share with them what's important to us. And I mean, I think this is a gift that we can give to other people. And this is something I think that's so sorely needed in the world. I mean, we look and there's so much strife and so much disconnection and so much disembodiment. How can we help people take a step towards healing those wounds?
One thing about all that that I'm feeling right now is your tenderness. I heard you say just a few moments ago, and in response to a kind of a thought experiment, when if you were to see someone having a little more red, a little more warmth, let's say in their face, color, to say you're I wish I could recreate it. It was sort of like something like, you know, it's like you're noticing something in a really warm and receptive and curious, inviting and welcoming way. I wonder if you could just maybe talk about that, the quality that I'm speaking to here, tenderness, welcoming, receptivity, gentleness, which seems, frankly, in terribly short supply in, you know, the kind of discourse we see in social media and in our politics and in our public life and even just in how people interact with their neighbors or their family members. Tenderness, so, or lack of tenderness.
I think tenderness has something to do with opening some of our internal space, like our heart space and our visceral space, and to communicate that to others, to be willing to communicate that to others. And if we look around in the world and just see how sorely that is needed, especially in many of the Western cultures. And that's about social intelligence, emotional social intelligence. And in our society, that is, I won't say it's non-existent, but it's pretty, it's not something that's usual. When you go to the somaticexperiencing.com website, somatic experiencing, one word, there's a link to a Marine that I worked with, Ray. It's called Ray's Story. And he was serving in Afghanistan and Iraq, and he was blown up by two of these IEDs and literally thrown into the air. And he woke up 2 weeks later in Germany in the hospital, Lowenstadt Hospital in Germany, unable to walk or to talk.
Yeah.
And when I saw him, he was still in pretty bad shape. He'd been diagnosed with depression, PTSD, anxiety disorder, Tourette's. But you don't get Tourette's overnight. Something precipitated that. And for me, it's very clear. We're talking about incomplete responses. He was trying to orient to where the sound of the blast came from, but it got immediately blocked thwarted. Mm. And then his whole body was contracting to protect, to make the exposed part of the body as small as he could when he's up in the air. And you see, after the first session, those convulsive movements, because he was able to complete that enough, he said, were 80% gone. Then we worked for about four or five more sessions. The last one was, I invited him to Esalen, where I was teaching a workshop. And you really see how a reflective human being he's become. And you really see how tender he is to his wife and his child. He couldn't do that at all. And it was scaring them because he was so abrupt and so angry. But that's what happens in trauma. You know, we get, not just in trauma, but we get caught up from those feelings. But they're there. They're part of our human DNA, our primate, our mammalian DNA.
So is there a typical arc to the work that you're doing with somebody, Peter, either you or a somatic experience trained person? When somebody comes in and is having similar experiences, they know that something has happened, or they have a sense of a long number of somethings that have happened. They know that it's attached to some kind of an experience that they're having right now that they're having a hard time working with or getting some distance from, and they want to feel better. Is there a kind of pathway that's typical for the work, or is it just completely individual?
Both. There are, you know, arcs, but it is individual, and that's important, actually, because every person is different. You sort of alluded to this. When I work with people, even though this may have to do with past events or even generational, ancestral effect, I work in the here and now. So we may reflect on some of these sensations and images, but it's in the present time. And so it's important before you excavate this kind of work, it's really essential that the person be able to have at least some modicum ability, capacity to be in the here and now, to be present. Otherwise, you can just, this can just result in regression. And, you know, regression is generally not helpful. So working in the here and now, reflecting perhaps on, well, certainly on sensations and feelings and images, and looking at memories when they do come up, and work with them to complete some of those incomplete responses, and then welcome them back. When we're able to look at some of these events that may have occurred, both positive and negative, the idea is not to get the memory, but really is to be able to come sufficiently into the here and now so you're not sucked into the vortex of trauma, to the black hole of trauma. You're able to have a distance. And mindfulness training can be useful also as an important part to develop those capacities, those skills, and they are skills. So that's the first thing I would say, that really to have the person, that they're anchored enough in the here and now so that they won't be overwhelmed. Because in terms of the nervous system, overwhelming the nervous system is no different than the original trauma, which overloaded the nervous system. So by just having them, you know, relive those events, it then, it takes away from their strength to heal in the here and now. And just want to also say that, you know, when I came out to Berkeley in 1964, I didn't know I had a body. I didn't know what a body was for, well, except for carrying my mind from one class to the next. I was in a way lost. I mean, like you said, you know, that you were there from your head up, from your neck up. And I definitely fit that description. So I have a really good friend, Jack Kaplan. He was one of the meditators at the Green Gulch Meditation Center in Marin. And Charlotte Selvers and her husband, Charles Brooks, were giving a workshop for the monks that resided there. But he was able to get me in, even though I wasn't. And so for all day long, we would pick up like a stone, hold it in our hands and feel its texture, feel its weight, feel its temperature. And then we would be walking around and feeling our feet as they contact the ground and then our ankles. And anyhow, this went on and on and on. And I remember meeting eye to eye with one of the monks. And I said, oh, how is this for you? I remember he said, oh, big headache. Anyhow, she had us laying down on the floor and had us do different things with our awareness, like actually feel like our breath coming in from our feet, up our legs, into our belly, and so forth. And of course, I know I'm a scientist type that you do not breathe through your feet. I mean, you may smell in your feet, but you don't breathe through your feet. But something actually quite miraculous happened. At the end, when we walked out, it was twilight, and looking down into the valley from above the church and then out to the Bay Bridge, and it was the most beautiful sight that I had ever seen. And I realized there was something here that was very important and something that I need to follow and explore and learn about.
There's a line in your book that really ties to something that I've been thinking a lot about recently. And it feels like such a huge part of this process for people who, particularly people who have experienced a significant amount of trauma in their life, is creating a concept of themselves as a thing from which they can derive safety.
Yeah.
So their safety is not just about the circumstance they're in. It's not just about the people that they're interacting with. Of course, these are important parts of it.
Yeah.
But they themselves are something that's helping them become safe. You know, they're agentic process. I'm wondering how you think people can develop that again, particularly one that's been so disrupted for them.
Well, you know, somatic experiencing is basically a bottom-up approach, in contrast to a lot of talk therapies, which are much more top-down. But somatic experience is both. You have to work together, but primarily starting from the bottom-up and then working from top-down, or even starting from top-down and then working more with bottom-up. And in doing that, we start to develop what sometimes is called a self-concept, a picture of who we are. And another thing, and that's a very positive thing, there's also a problematic part of the self-concept that sometimes people who are traumatized, that's worn as like on their sleeve as a badge of courage, which it is, but it's not who the person is. Yes, this happened to them, but they're not that person. They're not what happened. They are this self, this growing self, this emerging self, this new connection with self. And when we were able to do that, we feel more safe. You know, there are numbers of different exercises that I may do with people. So for example, this one I call the self-hug exercise. And when we just put our hands here and gently squeeze the muscles of our arms, often we'll feel like an inner movement beginning. And then if we follow this movement, it takes us into a deeper experience of the body. There's a wonderful saying from Papua New Guinea where they say knowledge does not exist unless it's in the body. And the self-concept really doesn't exist unless it's felt in the body.
I love that point there, Peter, about identification, because one of the things you said earlier in the conversation was the value of coming fully into the present. So of course we are, to some extent, our history.
Yep.
But we're also this other thing too. And this other thing too, it's whatever's going on right now. It's whatever's living into the future. It's tough to talk about because it does have a sort of like ephemeral feeling to it. But we are both of those things at the same time. So there can be an appreciation of what's happened with this kind of leaning into what else might be possible for a person.
I think that's about self-compassion. I really do. I've asked the question, Forrest, have I done enough? Have I done enough? And I can now answer that in the affirmative. Yes, I have done enough. And so I've let go of that. It doesn't hold me hostage anymore. But there's another question. And that question is a lot more difficult. And that is, am I enough? And I think that's something I'm gradually learning about and moving into. And in writing the book, I came much more to that self-concept of someone who is enough, that I don't have to add anything, that just being myself is enough.
There's a line in the book, Peter, related to experiences you had early on in life of abandonment, of being essentially left behind, left with your grandparents, right. Actually specifically, if I'm remembering correctly, by your parents when you were very, very young for a couple of weeks. And you talk in the book about being able to generate your own internal well-being, learning how to generate my own internal well-being. I thought that was such an interesting line. And in the book, you just kind of leave it there as this ongoing process, right, where it's something that you're still learning. And I just had to ask you about it. Like, what did you mean by that? And how are you learning how to do that?
Yeah, abandonment is a very primal wound. But specifically what happened to me is, I think I was about 6 months old, and my parents thought that my father might get drafted into World War II. And so they went on a vacation together, and I was left with my grandparents, who lived in a different part of that apartment complex. And they were good enough. They were not unkind, but they weren't my parents. And I cried inconsolably, and then finally I just stopped feeling. And when my parents did return, it's almost that I didn't recognize them. And you can imagine how this really can get into the way of intimate relationships, because I've been so blessed in my life. I'm a heterosexual person, and I've been with different women who have been so kind and generous and supportive that I was able to feel enough space to work with that abandonment, to own it, to not put it on them, and to not be in the place where I felt like I had to leave before they abandoned me. And again, I think that's the thing that we often do in relationships. We stop the relationships, we cut them off because we're afraid of being abandoned. And this is something that did not happen all at once. It took me many years, many encounters to really come at peace with that, to feel the procedural memory of my body bracing against the door and work with those images. And then, like you said, develop my internal sense of well-being. And I think when two people do that, develop their own internal sense of well-being, they've given themselves a gift to themselves and a gift to the other. And when both people have done that adequately, then we can celebrate joyfully the connection.
I'm reflecting on major takeaways for people working with this material on their own, as Forrest said, which will be most of the population most of the time. When I sort of reflect on this for myself and for people in general, I just want to share some of the headline takeaways that stand out for me. One is that your history matters. It's real. It happened. It's designed to affect you. You were affected by it in the ways that you were. There's an honesty and there's even a dignity in facing your own history. Second, you can't change what happened, but you can heal its effects on you today. Yes. It's lingering effects in your body, your emotions, how you approach things, including effects you're unaware of, as even exemplified by the recovery of a real memory of being assaulted.
Yes, that really happened, to be able to say that to oneself.
Yeah, it really did happen, and it really does happen. So there's a lot of hope here. Okay, so how to do it, right? So what are some of the keys? An awareness of the traces in the body, really instructive. And the body is often trying to tell you something. And the traces in the body and also elsewhere often indicate where your original natural healthy coping response was thwarted and frozen and incomplete. And so recovering that and getting in touch with it safely, swinging into it to touch it, then swinging away to resource yourself, swinging into it to become more and more aware, and then finding ways to complete that arc.
That's right.
Of healthy coping so your body can experience a completion around that trauma. It's just really, really powerful.
And it takes patience. I'm sorry.
Yeah, it takes patience. Thank you for jumping into my recap of your greatest hits. Here.
And it's also finding the correct teacher, because it's important who we tell our stories to. You know, they have to be a person of high integrity and capacity to be present, for sure.
Including yourself.
Yes, including
when you tell
myself.
Yourself the story, to be careful about reshaming yourself about it and dismissing it and, you know, internalizing as we do what others have done to you, but still try not to do it to yourself. And of course, be careful with not telling your story to people who dismiss it or deny it or...
Well, that happened a long time ago.
Yeah, not that. And then in all that, as Forrest was pointing out, the power and the importance of creating your own context of safety for yourself in your journey, right? Including if you do work with people who are less than perfect. I think there's a wide range of therapists, and a wide range of friends and parents and, you know, and others helping, you know, helping yourself get the most you can from people who are not perfect.
Yeah. I like that. Let me just add one other thing. I know we're coming to the end. You know, the last chapter in my book is titled Living My Dying, and it's starting to come to bring in my mortality and examine that. And I did that in a number of different ways. I did do a psychedelic experience once, which again gave me more of that feeling that, yes, death is inevitable, but it's not necessarily the end of the story. I came to, in one of those sessions, came to reconnecting with that vital child, even though he had experienced abandonment, that he was still there as this. I really embraced him. I felt love towards him and love from him. And one of the pictures here.
Oh, that's you.
Yeah, about 18 months old.
Oh, I remember seeing that in your book. It's very sweet.
Yeah, that's really great.
And that's where I want to return. That's about living my dying, of really caressing that beautiful, wonderful child, hug him, hold him close to me, and just feel the tears of gratitude.
Beautiful, beautiful, beautiful.
That's really sweet, Peter.
Well, maybe a lovely, lovely point to finish this conversation.
That was great. Really enjoyed both of you. And connecting with you again, you know, Rick, one of the commitments I made in writing the autobiography of trauma is that I would follow my truth wherever it took me. And it took me some places where I wish I wouldn't have gone there voluntarily, but I did. And they were important and they were, in a way, seminal. You know, there's a saying that when the student is ready, they will find a teacher. When the student is truly ready, that teacher will disappear, will go away. Hmm. And I think we all need that help, that connection from somebody who's a teacher, somebody who's grounded, who's embodied, who's open, and who's compassionate. And I think I would leave you with that thought.
Thank you so much, Peter. This has been really fantastic. We really appreciate it.
Oh, gosh, yeah, no kidding. That was really cool. Really cool.
We had a great time talking today with Dr. Peter Levine, the creator of the somatic experiencing approach to therapy. And this is normally when I would offer a summary of everything that we talked about during the episode, but Rick kind of already did that at the end of the conversation, where he gave a final summary not only of what we had talked about during the conversation, but of many of the key points of Peter's work. So I'm going to do a little bit less recapping during this outro and offer just a bit more context on somatic experiencing as a whole, if you're a bit less familiar with it, in a way that might help you understand some of the things that Peter was talking about during the conversation. In the somatic experiencing framework, trauma is when we are unable to complete the body's natural defensive mechanisms to a bad experience happening to us. Trauma occurs when we are trying to do something, when we're trying to fight or run away or hide, and we're unable to do that. Then, according to Peter, post-traumatic symptoms are the result of the body trying to complete that natural defensive response. In other words, the body has become essentially stuck in the moment of the traumatic experience, and it keeps on trying to complete a cycle that it's just never able to complete. So the past has become fully present for us. It is walking around with us as we're going about our day. And this is why Peter emphasized the importance of coming fully into the moment of the present experience, understanding that, yes, of course, our past has a lot to do with who we are now. We are formed based on our experiences, but we're also continuing to be formed into the future. And if we start to view ourselves as an outcome, as a calcified thing that is no longer capable of change, rather than as an ongoing, dynamic process, that's when symptomology becomes extremely difficult to work with or change in meaningful ways, because we've lost touch with the self-concept, the view of ourselves as somebody who can change and grow and improve and unburden ourselves from these things over time. And that view itself of yourself as something that can change, of yourself as something that can, as Peter said, like generate your own internal sense of well-being, that self-efficacy, that agency to fill out the being well bingo card, that's such a huge part of the process. And the more conversations that I have about these topics, the more focused I become on that as a key lever for people. And that's why I just thought it was so, I don't even know if I really have the right words here, so touching, so real, how Peter was open to bringing his own personal experiences into the conversation and into the book that he wrote as well. Because you can just tell that this is a person who has not, these questions are not academic for him in nature. They are intimate and practical and personal. And the methods that he's developed over the past 50 years to help people work with their own painful experiences are drawn in large part from his personal experience, trying to recover from his own painful past and helping so many other people around the world do the same. So again, thanks to Peter for joining us today for this conversation. It's always just a real treat to talk with him. And also he's just, you know, he's such a luminary in the field. It's a real privilege to be able to have that kind of a conversation with him. So again, Peter's new book is An Autobiography of Trauma, A Healing Journey. If you haven't read them already and you are interested in these topics, I would strongly recommend the books Waking the Tiger and Healing Trauma. They're two more foundational books that really explore somatic experiencing as a whole. And if you're trying to work on these issues inside of your own life, I would really strongly recommend them. If you've made it this far and you are somehow not subscribed to the podcast, wow, you should really subscribe to it. I would really appreciate it. That would really help us out. If you are listening to it right now and you want to be watching it instead, I have a YouTube channel. You can find me. It's Forrest Hansen on YouTube. The channel has been really growing recently, which has just been, you know, an amazing experience for me. I've been kind of overwhelmed by the support and I just so appreciate it. On the other hand, if you're watching it on YouTube and you would rather listen, hey, we've got a podcast and you can find us basically wherever you listen to your podcasts. If you'd like to support us in other ways, you can also find us on Patreon. It's patreon.com/beingwellpodcast. And for just a couple of dollars a month, you can support the show and receive a bunch of bonuses in return. Until next time, thanks for listening, and we'll talk to you soon.